just noise in my head. Lead me on, let me stand. I am tired, I am weak, I am worn through the storm, through the night. Lead me on to the light. In my hand, let the Lord be.
Take My Hand, Precious Lord, R.H. Harris and the Soul Stirrers, recorded in 1939. The tune was composed by the most famous gospel hymnist of all time, Thomas Dorsey, and R.H. Harris, who died just a few months ago, one of the most influential gospel singers of all time. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Gospel music, our topic in this portion of the program. Two guests join us this afternoon, Horace Clarence Boyer and Lloyd Yearwood. The two have collaborated on a book on gospel, The Golden Age of Gospel. Horace Boyer writing the text, Lloyd Yearwood the photographer. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments on gospel for our guests. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Horace Boyer is a gospel performer, one of the Boyer brothers. He is also a composer and scholar. He's professor emeritus of music at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He is the editor of Lift Every Voice and Sing, an African-American hymnal. Lloyd Yearwood is an award-winning photographer whose work has appeared in numerous magazines, motion pictures, and exhibits. Their book, The Golden Age of Gospel, is published by the University of Illinois Press. It is a volume in the U of I Press series, Music in American Life. Our telephone numbers again, 333-WILL, that's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. Horace Boyer, Lloyd Yearwood, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Amherst, Massachusetts, where I'm speaking to you from, and Lloyd is in New York, but I wanted to say this. How magnificent to begin this program with Precious Lord, Take My Hand, for two reasons. Number one, it is the most popular gospel song composed by a black person in the world. The most popular gospel song among all black people is Amazing Grace, which isn't a gospel song at all, but which is gospelized. And Thomas A. Dorsey, who wrote Precious Lord, Take My Hand in 1932, was so prodigious in gospel that he is called the father of black gospel. And it's a wonderful treat to begin this whole discussion of African-American gospel music with a Dorsey composition in Precious Lord on top of that.
Yeah, it is so beautiful and it is so haunting. I've been humming this melody now for a couple of days as I prepared for the program.
You know, I found it interesting. R.H. Harris, as you said, of course, was the inspiration for 95% of the gospel singers who came after, the male gospel singers who came after him. And, of course, you know, Sam Cooke took his place in the Soul Stirrers in 1950 when R.H. Harris left. But I thought it was wonderful of him to do the first chorus in a choral style with all of the voices together the way Dorsey wrote it. And then they made a call and response version of it later with R.H. leading and the Soul Stirrers responding so that we get the two elements of its performance style that has come into our present day.
Yeah. Thomas Dorsey, prolific composer, composing like 500?
Well, we have over 1,000 of his songs that he composed, and actually he didn't know how many he wrote himself. Because what he would do would be to write a song, teach it. Although he was very good about copyrighting his material. I cataloged about 150 of those in a presentation at the Smithsonian several years ago. He was very good about cataloging his songs, but he would wait and copyright 50 at a time. So that there may have been others that we don't even know about. Fortunately, he organized in 1932, a gospel convention where people would come and learn this gospel style because, you know, the gospel musical style was, for Baptists, the new music in the 1930s, the sanctified style of singing in the Pentecostal church from which we get this gospel was as old as the 1910s, but it wasn't as dignified and organized is what Dorsey was doing. And so Dorsey organized a convention in 1932 where people would come from all over the United States and learn to sing the songs and take them back to their choirs. And each year at the convention, he would introduce four or five of his. He was a good businessman.
Yeah. While you mention that, let me mention an event coming up this week here at the University of Illinois. The 5th Symposium on Black Sacred Music begins Thursday the 15th and continues through Saturday here. The symposium is presented by the University of Illinois Black Chorus, Dr. Ollie Watts Davis, conductor. And the symposium concludes Saturday evening with a concert in the Great Hall of the Krannert Center for Performing Arts. And so if folks out there would like more information about the symposium and Saturday evening's concert, give the folks at the African American Cultural Program a telephone call. And that number is 333-2092, 333-2092, the area code 217. So let's now say good afternoon as well to Lloyd Yearwood. And Lloyd, how was it that you've taken so many photographs of so many gospel music greats?
Well, first of all, I'd like to tell how Horace and I met.
Okay.
If Horace can remember.
Yes.
He gave a performance in Harlem at the Studio Museum, and he brought with him a drummer and a bass player. Mm-hmm. And I was so impressed with his rendition and explanation of the gospel music that I wrote him a letter and sent him a picture with his friends ever since. Is that right, Horace?
That's right. And actually, when we started this book, they said, we want some photography. And then Lloyd had told me that for 40 years, he had been taking photographs of all the gospel singers in New York, as you can see in the book. And we went, and his catalog is unbelievable.
But I started, oddly enough, too, I did not come out of an environment where gospel singing was sung. I was born Episcopalian, raised up in an Episcopalian church. I never heard gospel, really, until I came to New York City. But there, in Philadelphia, I guess Horace will attest to this, that on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, if you're black or anywhere near black, you listen to Wings Over Jordan.
Yes, indeed.
And that, and I remember also hearing Rosetta Thorpe, our swinging religious music. He thought this was terrible, not realizing that years later I would be photographing Rosetta Thorpe.
Mm-hmm. There's
now
a photo.
I happened to come into gospel singing. I was taking photographs for quite a while, but there, once in a while I might photograph a gospel singer, but there it was all flash. And I wasn't too happy with the results. And then Hodak came out with this Tri-X film where you didn't need flash. And then I saw where I could get these wonderful action pictures, you know, which really did not, the flash erased the feeling of it. So this is how I got into, you know, photographing gospel singers, because they're not easy to photograph.
Why aren't they
and
easy?
And it was a challenge.
Why are they hard to photograph?
Because they move by the spirit, and you got to be in the spirit too to find out, you know, different to catch to capture the moves. And as you look in my book, you can see. Everything is moving. Very few
in
of my
constant movement.
Yes, you know, and very few of my pictures are really posed pictures.
Yeah, there's a wonderful picture. I'm thinking of a picture in movement of the Dixie Hummingbirds.
Oh, yeah.
Where the group, you can feel their movement.
That's a famous photograph right there, too.
Well,
it's as if you see them, and the next minute they've moved.
Yeah, well, that picture was terrifying to take. Because I shot those pictures with a Rolleiflex. You have to look into the ground glass. You're not really looking toward what you're photographing because it's all in the ground glass. And Ira Tucker kept coming nearer and nearer and nearer to me. And in fact, I thought he was going to topple over the camera. But luckily, I got the shot.
Listen, Ira Tucker, the leader of the Dixie Hummingbirds, was one of the most charismatic performers, but he was the one who introduced physicality into quartet singing.
Yes, indeed.
Because the quartet singers came from the Fisk Jubilee tradition, where they simply stood in quartet concert formation and just moved very slightly. When and Ira Tucker, all of a sudden in the late 40s and early 50s, began to run down aisles and jump from stages and just tear the house up with his singing and his movement.
And it's very difficult to photograph them, to even capture them at all, and especially when you're not using a flash, know, which was very difficult. But Ira Tucker, I met him about 4 or 5 years ago again when we were doing an interview at another radio station, Columbia University radio station here in New York, and he is the funniest person. He can tell the most awesome jokes about gospel singers, which would not bear repeating.
and of course, he sang with all of them.
Yeah,
over the time, yes, and is still singing.
Oh yes,
and still singing, even though he was born in 1928.
Right,
he's still singing with the Dixie Hummingbirds.
Yeah, well, he's the last of the originals.
That's right.
That is singing, and his voice it sounds almost like it did, you know, in those days.
Yeah,
you know, it's just amazing.
Celeste, we didn't mean to take the discussion away from you.
Well, you guys are you sound great, and I'll just try and keep up with you. I wanted to ask you about the Golden Age of Gospel, which is the title of the book. When does the Golden Age begin? And, you know, you mentioned now we're here where there are just a few of the originals left.
Yes.
You know, where are we today?
Listen, Gospel has unfolded in four large areas. The first one was from 1906 until 1920. Now, in 1906 in Los Angeles, California, we have the founding of the Black Pentecostal Church. And I want to tell you, the singing that the Pentecostalist sanctified holiness congregations did would not permit you to sit in your seats. And in addition, they were clapping their hands and beating the drums and the tambourine. Well, now listen.
Well, Rosetta Tharpe is a good example of
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Now, what happened was the Baptist heard this music, but that was a little too ecstatic for them, and they began to refine it. So in 1921, the Baptist National Convention, which is the largest organization of black Christians, publishes a collection of songs under the title Gospel Pearls. This is in 1921. And then from 1921 until 1944, all of the Baptists began to sing gospel and to produce a kind of, in comparison, a subdued, dignified type of ecstatic music. So that's the development. And then now the creation, of course, comes from 21 to from 1906 to 1920. 21 to 44 is the development. And in 1945, listen to this, Mahalia Jackson quit her full-time job as a beautician. She had a two-chair beauty parlor in Chicago, and Mahalia gave up her chairs and went on the road as a full-time gospel singer, and other gospel singers followed her.
And the rest was history.
And that then becomes the golden age, that period from 1945 up until about 1963 or 65. Every town worth its salt produces two or three gospel singers. They begin to make records. We have these extravaganzas where there are 15 to 20. There was a man in Newark, New Jersey named Ronnie Williams,
yes,
who used to put on gospel extravaganzas with 20 different gospel acts lasting all day Sunday. Now, in the 60s, by the 1960s, of course, Sam Cooke, Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles had picked up his gospel movement. James Brown has picked up this fervor of God. All of this is the gospel movement that's influencing these people. And, of course, when they mix it together, rhythm and blues with a good gospel bass, they call it soul. You can hear the black church in soul music.
Mm-hmm. Harris, say something about Johnny Myers, because he, I think, preceded Ronnie Williams.
Yes, Johnny Myers now was the New York promoter. There's something interesting about Johnny Myers, though. Johnny Myers always was a little bit more dignified and a little bit more classy in his presence.
He used to fly from one engagement to the other.
Oh, yes, he was
all over the country.
And he was he introduced Mahalia
Jackson
to New York society and actually took her to Carnegie Hall in 1950.
Wasn't it Joe Bostick?
Oh, that's right. Joe took her to Carnegie Hall.
But that photograph in my book of Johnny Myers and Mahalia.
Yes.
He was at her concert, of course.
Uh-huh.
And he begged me, said, "Please, I want you to take a picture of Mahalia and me."
Oh, he did.
Yes. He begged me for that picture.
Oh.
And Mahalia was in the back room after she had finished her concert, then she changed over to her street dress.
Yes.
And Mahalia was very gracious about it.
Uh-huh.
But I'm sad to say that Johnny Myers never saw that picture.
Oh, what happened?
He died about 6 months later.
Oh.
And he never saw the picture. But I'm so happy that it's in the book and that it keeps his name alive, because
yes,
he really was one of the great pioneers, and he's always said he discovered Mahalia.
Yeah, well, he didn't take her to Carnegie Hall, but he did present her in the other venues.
Oh, yes, before Carnegie Hall,
right,
he was presenting her around the country.
Yeah. Now, something interesting happened in the 60s when gospel became thoroughly popular. It began to adopt some of the music of, I think the church calls it, the world.
Yeah.
Picking up a little rhythm and blues here, a little rhythm and jazz here, and a little pop music here. And by 1969, when Edwin Hawkins releases Oh Happy Day, instead of the producers sending the record to a black radio station, they sent it to a white top 40 radio station so that it becomes number one on the hit parade for 2 weeks. And from that point on, of course, gospel music then is directed toward a multiracial, multifunctional audience. It's not necessarily exclusively in the ghetto nor the black church.
Is it really gospel as we know gospel to be?
It's not the same thing. But when you begin to fuse, so that this period from 1969 to the present time is called contemporary gospel, meaning contemporary is a euphemism for fusing. The same thing has happened in country music. Mm. The same thing happened in jazz. And you get a kind of music which is part country, but part pop. Well, I'm thinking of someone like Dolly Parton or some of the others. And you get someone in gospel like Kirk Franklin, who is the newest sensation, who sings a kind of gospel, but there's as much hip-hop in the gospel as traditional gospel.
Hasn't gospel, though, always been a fusion? I mean, when you think that it came out of...
Absolutely not.
Okay.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because all of the people who heard gospel had heard blues first, and they thought gospel came from blues, and it's the other way around. The jazz musicians were stealing from the church music.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody knew about the church music because nobody was going to the black church, and they weren't the ones in the club. So that by the time that they heard gospel, they thought that blues and jazz had come first. But the church, the Negro spirit, but listen, the
Negro
gospel
spiritual
song
really
is the grandchild of the Negro spiritual.
Right.
The spiritual has all of the elements that gospel has in it. And I'm so glad you brought it up, because it's the one weak spot that I can't take.
What about when gospel people like Sam Cooke went over to jazz, and they were in trouble?
Yeah.
But
you know what's interesting is when Sam Cooke and Aretha Franklin started singing pop music, the only thing they changed were the words. Aretha is still a gospel singer.
Yes, Sam mm-hmm.
Cooke was still a gospel singer. Ray Charles tries his level best to sound like the Five Blind Boys of Mississippi.
Okay.
And I know this because when I was a kid, Ray Charles sounded just like Nat King Cole.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then when he discovered gospel, and he talks about this in his book, Brother Ray, how he made that transition. So, no, the church provided the material for so much of jazz. As a matter of fact, when they created jazz in the early part of this century, they used When the Saints Go Marching In and Just Over in Glory Land. They used a lot of the hymns to play. Louis Armstrong played them all the time.
Well, what I think the purest of the gospel singers was Roberta Martin.
Yes,
you say. I've heard her about 3 or 4 times, and it's really quite a physical experience,
yes,
you know, to hear Roberta Martin singers and the reaction of the audience. Now, that particular picture that I have in the book, I paid dearly for that one.
Yeah.
Because I was sitting in a crowded church, and a woman sitting next to me kept screaming out for them to sing Grace, sing Grace, sing Grace.
Oh, sure.
And so Roberta Martin finally struck the chord to sing Grace, and she got happy and slapped me right across the mouth. Luckily, I had taken the picture first, you know, while they were getting ready to sing. And when she said that, and it was a very hard blow.
Oh, dear.
I was devastated for the rest of the concert.
Let me draw your attention, Lloyd, to another photograph that's in the book. It's wonderful, and it must have been a much more peaceful moment for you as a photographer. And this is a photograph of Sam Cooke. Standing in front of the microphone. He's so young. And
that picture.
And that's such a beautiful expression on his face.
That's
so,
my favorite picture of him. I'm blessed to have gotten a picture like
that. Where'd you take it, Lloyd?
I was taking it at the Apollo Theater.
Oh.
I couldn't imagine anybody that young could sing with such spiritual experience. as Sam Cooke was singing that day, and the audience was in a state.
Now, this was his during his gospel singing career.
Right. It was the Soul Stirrers. He was there with the Soul Stirrers.
Yeah,
Here again, most of those pictures, when you're taking pictures of a gospel, a real gospel concert, you're lucky that you get one good shot. You just can't say, And that Sam Cooke picture was my lucky one shot, as the Clara Ward and the Marianne Williams pictures were. And once you get that shot, especially with a 2¼ square negative picture, then the rest, the big job is going to the dark room to create, make sure that you get everything out of that one negative.
Yeah. You know, I have some music here. Sam Cooke performing with the Soul Stirrers. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe we could listen to a bit of this.
That would be wonderful.
Great.
This is a tune called The Last Mile of the Way.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
If I walk in the pathway of duty, if I work till the close of the day, Lord, I shall see.
Mile of the Way, the Soul Stirrers with Sam Cooke. Okay, guys, we can hear you in the background. What are you talking about there?
Oh, Horace, why is it that the gospel singers have such clear diction? You have no problem at all of understanding what they're singing.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's imitation. We picked it up from the early gospel singers, like the Wings over Jordan, who were sort of quasi-gospel, but the early gospel singers were those people who were attempting to sort of persuade you, and they wanted to be understood. Incidentally, now Sam sang the verse on that, and I think Paul Beasley came in on the chorus. But what I wanted to say was, what a gorgeous voice!
What
purity!
What diction!
Yes, and what sincerity!
Oh yes,
that actually came through. So
yes.
That for the moment that you
the photograph
for the mm-hmm. moment that you're singing that song, and I've seen the gospel singers, the moment that they're singing that song, they absolutely believe in what they're singing, and you couldn't shake them from that belief.
No.
And that's the wonderful thing, I think, about it. You know, sometimes a blues singer will sing a song or a jazz singer, and they're really concerned about getting the right note
mm-hmm.
or being with the band. A gospel singer will say, well, just keep up with me if you can. And then they will go forward. But that's quite an extraordinary.
Well, you know, the Dixie Hummingbirds have strict moral codes.
Yes.
And there a couple of them fell out, and they got rid of them until they straightened themselves up. And
yes.
Then they brought them back in.
Many of the early quartets had a code of conduct. As a matter of fact, for the Fairfield Four, I have that rule of conduct in there. No drinking, no smoking. You must be on time for the concert. You must wear this. You can't be bothered with women at the concert.
Right. So, no drinking.
And they called them clubs.
Uh-huh.
So that you paid dues, and it was a wonderful. I also mentioned the fact that the quartet movement, and this is very important, in the 30s and 40s and 50s gave young black men, some of whom were not educated, an opportunity to become role models in the black community, not only for their lives, but for their great music, and it elevated them and inspired other young men and women to live a better life and to make some sort of contribution. And
they
I think that's wonderful.
Uh-huh, that's what they were. But, you know, in most of these gospel concerts, you had to have a quartet. If it weren't no quartet,
now,
there would be no women there.
Yeah, that's right. So let me explain to you what he means by that. In the 1940s, for the first time, we began to get female gospel groups.
Mm-hmm.
All women. Now, these women are not singing a cappella. They're being accompanied by piano and organ. The men were in the 1940s were just coming to the guitar because they sang a cappella. Now, the gospel crowd is a female crowd, so that if you only had women gospel singers, you'd have some women, but not as many as you would if you have a handsome guy like Sam Cooke up there or like Ira Tucker singing.
Right.
So that there was a little bit of a social aspect to all of this as well.
They were the idols. They were the matinee idols.
Oh, of course. That's exactly right.
That picture of Sam Cooke and Ira Tucker, I mean, these are handsome.
Yeah, and that's why, of course, Sam Cooke couldn't last in gospel. I remember my brother and I went once to a concert of his in the early 50s, and we couldn't get in the church for the women.
That's
I mean, young women, and they weren't there just to hear him sing either.
Oh, no.
They were there to get a good look.
And to see him perform.
Well, that's why they had those codes of conduct.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, they were necessary.
Plenty of temptation.
You know, and it was kind of interesting. I was a little taken aback because black church women were expected to behave in a certain way. But when you're young, you can only behave up to a certain point.
Well, they let their hair down.
Yes.
Well, now, who was drawn? What was the crowd like for a Mahalia Jackson concert?
Oh, now, why don't you talk about that, Lord, because you saw her often.
Well, I'll tell you, when I first saw Mahalia Jackson, I had to travel to Newark, New Jersey. And on that bill was the Ward singers, and there were about four or five other singers, the Ivory singers. And they were so good. And Mahalia Jackson was sitting in the audience in the back.
Oh, really?
Very demurely. She had on a blue silk or a dress.
Mm.
And the Ward singers and these other singers just rocked that church. I said to myself, because I had never seen Mahalia in person, I said, well, she could never beat that.
Uh-huh.
You know, I really meant it. I said, I said, no use of her getting up there to sing.
And then, listen, did she start off with a slow song?
She started off with A City Called Heaven.
Oh, Lordy. Oh,
and
my goodness.
When she got through with A City Called Heaven,
listen,
she had that microphone in her hand like it was a matchstick.
Absolutely.
And she went all the way down to the ground, all to the floor, and came up again. And she mesmerized.
Absolutely.
She mesmerized the audience. I was thinking it was impossible for anybody to do anything better, but she was just dynamic.
Listen, Celeste, I still say that 28 years after her death, Mahalia Jackson is still the most phenomenal gospel singer that has been produced. Her audience was an adult audience, although children were being attracted to her, but her audience was adult, it was biracial, and it was not necessarily people who were going to church, because there was something, in the first place, she had the most gorgeous voice. You know that her inspiration was Bessie Smith. You can hear that in her voice.
Oh, yeah. And she's very professional.
Yes, she didn't, now the ward singers could jump up and down, but Mahalia was a little bit more sedate, and she let her singing do it for her. The first time I heard her, my brother and I were on our way home to Florida from Terre Haute, Indiana, and we stopped in Nashville off the bus, and she was on there with the ward singers. The ward singers came on first, and they tore up with Surely God Is Able, had the people screaming, and then Mahalia and Mildred came on by herself, and Mahalia started out with one of those slow songs, and I'll tell you, by the time she finished, the ushers didn't know what to do with all the with all the people that were just stretched out on the floor.
Well, when I was a little girl, I loved the Motown sound.
Yes.
And then I heard Mahalia Jackson one day, and I fell in love with her.
Yeah.
You know? Had to see her to really appreciate her.
You know, I believe the Lord distributes talent in great ways ever so often. And Mahalia had an abundance of pure talent because she only had one half a voice lesson in her life.
Yeah.
And she didn't like the way the voice teacher was treating her, so she left. And what you heard Mahalia give was what God gave to her.
Right, yeah. Right.
I was so surprised to read in the book that she was in her mid-30s when she had her first recording success.
Well, she did a recording in 1936 and 37, and they didn't do anything at all. So she was in her middle 30s, late 30s by the time she got to Apollo, and Move On Up a Little Higher didn't come out until 1950. By the time, and Mahalia was born in 1911.
Right.
But to be a great gospel singer, you have to have experience. 30 is kind of young. You know, you have to live the life to sing.
I know, but when I think of her, you know, earning a living as a beautician and you know, really scrambling and struggling for so long, it's so sad.
Yeah, and you know,
not so much sad. It gave her that experience to sing the way she sang.
Yeah.
And I got a chance to. I got to know her fairly well, and we were, my brother and I were asking her, Mahalia, how did you feel when you gave up your shop and went out to sing? She said, I felt that this is what the Lord wanted me to do, and I told him if he would look after me, I would step out on his word. She was one of the first gospel singers who gave up their 9-to-5. Because all gospel singers worked and then took off on the weekends or took a week off. And she gave hers up, and of course it then inspired other people.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, as soon as she, Mahalia was a leader. So whatever Mahalia did, other people did.
Well, I guess when I said sad, you know, I guess I was thinking selfishly in terms of audiences, you know?
Yeah.
Well, in a black community, an audience, you have to earn it. You know, you just don't get up there and sing. You have to give them your all.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, they'll tell you.
Celeste, we didn't get any phone calls, or did we talk too much?
Well, we're talking pretty good here, and I've got some more music to play, and I bet you people are just enjoying listening to the two of you talk. And then, I mean, who's going to call in and interrupt Sam Cooke?
And Howard, say something about the Ward singers and Gertrude Ward.
Yes. Now, other people may disagree with me, but I followed the Ward singers from the late 40s until the middle 60s. And Clara Ward was perhaps the most talented musical arranger that gospel produced.
That's
now,
right.
For example, up until the Ward singers made their big hit in the middle 40s, female groups patterned themselves after male groups.
Mm-hmm.
They sang a cappella,
right.
And they sang in a bass voice, and they sang in a tenor voice. And here is Clara Ward, who says, but we're women, we have this wonderful treble quality. And she moved that voices up a register and arranged that harmony so that it was tight.
That's right.
Accentuation.
And it was coloratura. Those girls reached.
They were up above high C.
That's correct.
And when you heard that sound come out there, it was like heaven.
Oh yes.
This was Clara Ward and the Ward singers.
And that picture of that's on the cover and on page four with her, Clara Ward and Marion Williams.
Yes.
They were singing the old Rugged Cross.
Oh, is that what they were singing?
They were singing. And our Gertrude Ward got so happy that she almost pushed Clara off the stage.
Now, yeah. Gertrude is Clara's mother.
you know, Gertrude got happy right on that stage. That was some rendition of that number, the old Rugged Cross.
Well, you certainly have captured these folks when they are just in a moment of, they are so absorbed.
Right.
That picture on the cover is unbelievable of Clara and Marion in the climax of something. And for that moment, they are absolutely focused on what they're doing.
That's
and
right.
You can see it's coming from their very soul.
From their very soul, from their guts.
Yeah, and they look as though they are one.
Yes.
Well, they were. They were. The old Rugged Cross.
We've got some listeners who are waiting to talk with us now.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay.
Because your prompt, Horace, I think inspired some folks to go to the telephone.
So, okay.
So let's go first to a caller on line one in Philo. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Celeste, I'd like to ask your guest today what their opinion is of the modern contemporary Christian music. So many times today when I listen to that, I feel that it's more of a person's in there for the money or the notoriety rather than the spirit of the music. I'll hang up and listen to your answer, please. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'll let Horace answer that. All I can say is that I'm not too happy about
it. Well, I'll tell you, you have to be very careful of our answers because both Lloyd and I are from a different generation than those people who are making the music. But this is what I have noticed. In the earlier days, there was an attempt to be different in church music, in gospel music, to keep the music closer to what
sacred.
Yes, what a sacred or religious sound would be, and therefore it was a unique sound. What the contemporary performers have done is to combine so much of American popular music with gospel that in some cases you can't distinguish gospel from the popular music because they've gone so much toward jazz or rhythm and blues or bebop or pop. So I think that I think that's necessary, but I'm looking forward to the day when it will have spent itself, and therefore it'll go back to the real virtue. And that always happens. You go to a precipice and you fall over and then you come back.
But they got one foot in one area and another foot in the other area, so they're sort of like in purgatory.
Exactly.
Let's talk with another listener on line two in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I just called to tell you it's fascinating to listen to your stories, and I wish this went on all afternoon. This is a great show.
I'm sorry we talked too much. I'm in Massachusetts and Lloyd is in New York, and we don't get to see each other too often. So we are, and oddly enough, I'm hearing for the first time the circumstances around his taking these photographs. One of the editors and I spent a complete afternoon looking through his catalog, but we were just looking for the better pictures, and now I'm getting to hear what he went through to get them, and it's really quite fascinating.
Oh, it is.
Lloyd, I think that makes a book right there.
I agree, and I think what's fun is listening to your conversation. It's like listening in on somebody's dinner. It's wonderful. And I wanted to thank our hostess for allowing this kind of a show to happen. What a treat.
Well,
thank you.
I look forward to these shows in the afternoon, and I happen to be home today, and I feel very blessed to have gotten to hear this.
Book.
Yes, I agree. If you haven't had a chance to get the book, you've got to get the book and see these marvelous pictures. And we attempt to not only give some biography and something about the situation, but also to analyze the music that they're singing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank the listener for that call. It's a marvelous compliment.
Thank
you so much. We're here at the end of the time that we can spend together today, but you guys, you're welcome anytime.
Well, call us anytime.
Okay.
Well, listen, Thank you so very much for having us on.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. My pleasure. And here this afternoon, I'd also like to thank the program director for our companion station, WILL-FM, for his help in pulling together some of the music that we're featuring today here on the Afternoon Magazine. So, Jake Schumacher, thank you very much. Let's go out here with Mahalia Jackson. Move on up a little higher.
One of these mornings, soon in the morning, I'm gonna lead on my cross, get me a crown. Late one evening,
this is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn, and I thank our guests this afternoon, Horace Clarence Boyer, and Lloyd Yearwood. Together, they have collaborated on The Golden Age of Gospel, the text by Horace Boyer, the photography by Lloyd Yearwood. The book is out in paperback from the University of Illinois Press. It is a volume in the U of I Press series, Music in American Life, The Golden Age of Gospel.